critically analyzing global affairs. This is the Hervoy Moritz Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I hope that everyone is doing well. Some news real quick. The BRICS machine is marching on. It's being reported that Putin vows to reroute Russian exports to BRICS nations. Today, Putin said that Moscow was in the process of redirecting its trade and oil exports to BRICS countries as a result of Western sanctions. The economies of the BRICS nations account for more than 40% of the global population. Of course, they're talking about adding Argentina and Saudi Arabia. I guess that would become BRICSAS. BRICSASA, Saudi Arabia, something like that. BRICSASA, BRICS could become BRICSASA. But you know what's interesting? This morning I stopped to think for a moment. We hear all this talk about the end of the unipolar, multipolar, BRICS world, right? And I'm like, well, let's go back. Who created, because we got Putin, the Russians, and Xi running with the whole BRICS program, talking about global currency, a new international global currency basket based on the BRICS countries. Where did the idea come from? It's actually quite shocking. BRICS was the idea of BRICS, of the current form of the multipolar world. Guess where it came from? Rupa Purushottaman, together with Jim O'Neill, both of Goldman Sachs. And Rupa just happens to be a World Economic Forum graduate and young global leader. And she came up with the whole BRICS idea some 21 years ago. So BRICS was a Davos project that she and Vlad are running with. Really just makes you think. Really makes you think what's going on here, and kind of solidifies my thesis on kind of the whole great reset thing of what's going on. And there really are no good guys. It's really weird. I mean, you just got to think about it. BRICS came from a young global leader and Goldman Sachs. You trust the banks, Goldman Sachs? So that is weird. In other news, Airbus, the EU champion, Politico is reporting, has deep links to the Chinese military industrial complex. So this is really sort of a theme today, my discovery of where BRICS came from, this Politico piece on how EU Airbus has deep links to the Chinese military industrial complex, that the plane maker has key manufacturing facilities in China, and its local CEO is a member of the Communist Party, and that Airbus has advanced technology sharing and manufacturing agreements with entities linked to China's state-run military apparatus. So just weird stuff going on. And to top that off, Dan Collins, who works in China, on Twitter, he was suggesting a book called The Rare Metals War, and his 140-character summary says, this book details the Clinton administration forcing the American government to share ballistic missile tech with China and organizing the sale of the last American rare earth magnet producer to China. Heavy 1996 campaign contributions to the Clintons from the People's Liberation Army. So we see a lot of working together between East and West elites. It kind of, all this evidence goes against this idea that, there's this antagonism between the two. But nonetheless, I think both are true. It's really weird. It's really difficult trying to figure out what is going on here. We also had the former Defense Secretary Gates saying China could bring Taiwan to its knees without invading. Robert Gates, that is. He said the Chinese President Xi Jinping can bring enormous pressure on Taiwan without ever firing a shot through cyber and economic measures. He could bring Taiwan to its knees and create huge incentives for Taiwan to have a very different attitude toward China. He says he doesn't think that there is any threat of an imminent full-scale invasion of Taiwan by China, and that it would look something like D-Day and would have to be huge and require a lot of softening up. So yeah, interesting day today, and this is TNT Radio.
Real talk when you need it most.
It's the topics that matter to me.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
It's the Hrvoje Moric Show. I hope everyone is doing well. You're listening to us on TNTRadio.live or perhaps on the smartphone app. Get that and subscribe to us on Rumble, YouTube, or Odyssey, where we're also streaming. Perhaps you're listening from one of those vantage points. I'm joined again with my weekly guest, Jose Nino, Venezuelan American. He's got more than a decade of experience as a political operative, works with a number of organizations and a host of political issues from gun rights to foreign policy. As a policy analyst, copywriter, he's got years of experience writing for a number of outlets, Ammo, Gunpowder Magazine, Mises, Big League Politics, and a number of others. His articles have been featured on Business Insider, InfoWars, Zero Hedge. He's been on the Tom Woods Show and elsewhere. You can find him on Twitter at Jose A.L. Nino, and his Substack is josbcf.substack.com. He's got a lot of great podcasts where he's interviewing high-level guests as well. How is life, Jose?
I'm doing fantastic, Herboye.
It's good to hear that you're doing fantastic, given all the craziness that's going on.
Yeah.
Around us, never a shortage of crazy. What's on Jose Nino's radar lately?
Well, there was that Supreme Court ruling today that was actually pretty favorable for gun owners in the U.S., where the Supreme Court ruled that New York State may issue carry restriction is unconstitutional. In other words, before this ruling, the state of New York initially required concealed carry applicants to demonstrate a quote-unquote special need outside of self-defense to obtain a concealed carry license. And now, if you're just like a normal law-abiding citizen in New York and you apply for a license, you will be, and you pass all the requirements there, you will not need to jump extra hoops or rely like on a sheriff's discretion to obtain a license. You get it automatically after you hit all the check boxes. So that's a good start. Though the New York state government responded with a kind of like statement saying that they're going to try to tighten gun control laws there, regardless of what the Supreme Court says. So there'll be some legal drama, but this does highlight a point that I have stressed, that we are seeing mass polarization in the U.S. where certain policies like, say, gun rights and abortion, you will see a patchwork of states, localities, and even counties have like their own policies. Like, say, for example, Texas will be relatively pro-gun, whereas New York will be a strictly gun control state. And you're going to see a lot of this type of policy segregation. But overall, this was a pretty solid victory for gun owners because it does take a shot at the concept of like may issue carry and allows for more further liberalization of concealed carry laws. And just overall, it changes the entire discourse as well, now that it's basically assumed that the Second Amendment does apply to the carry of firearms in public places. So it is normalizing that concept. And we'll see what happens. But on that front, I do think that the Second Amendment is one of like the few bright spots for any like pro-freedom person or anyone on the right, that they can kind of take solace in seeing that there have been solid victories, not only at the Supreme Court, but also at the state level and local level as well.
Hey, even given what's transpired the past 2 years, we've been reading about even people who are not on the right, left, or whatever, going out to buy guns because of the whole Antifa BLM, just the burning down of everything, all this madness. So, yeah, people realize they need to defend themselves. And you did, yesterday I was chatting with Spike Cohen, the former libertarian candidate, I think was for vice president. Very smart, well-spoken guy. We were talking about guns as well. And yeah, I briefly saw what you were talking about, this positive development in terms of gun rights today. But you also wrote about Arizona Congressman Andy Biggs saying that we should expect to see the gun control crowd go after ammunition and ammunition manufacturers, and that there are still several gun control bills. I mean, kind of as you said right now, things look bright, but they will never stop, these people. They're just not stopping. Yeah, what do you see on this front with the ammo?
That's one way they're going to start doing it, because the Supreme Court has thrown wrenches in the Gun Control Inc.'s plots to undermine the Second Amendment. So these guys are pivoting to a multitude of ways. They will target gun manufacturers through lawsuits to try to bankrupt a lot of gun manufacturers, thus reducing the supply of firearms available for people to obtain. And then they'll target ammo and just make it as like expensive as possible to run a business. Like I said in a previous episode that we were on, that they are kind of going towards a Mexicanization of like firearm stores, where there will be like, I think they want it to be to reach the point where there's like only like one gun store in the entire country. And that's what they're like aiming for now that they can't like fully ban firearm ownership. So they're going to try to make it as costly as possible to operate gun stores. So they'll go that route. These people are relentless. And I also do think that they may start getting big tech to get involved, and also the banking system as well, to start depriving a lot of these gun stores of funds like loans and other stuff, and try to like ultimately debank them. Some states have actually proactively passed measures to prevent that kind of stuff, but it's multi-pronged. These people don't rest. So just because we had a Supreme Court ruling today does not mean this fight is over. It's just a positive development, but we should not just say, oh, let's pack up our bags and leave, because the fight is only just beginning. And yeah, that's like where I do think that they're going to continue to start pressing the issue on other ways to do that. And they're going to do it very unconventional, because we live in a time where it's no longer like a private versus like public sector thing. And this applies as well with free speech, where you see like some of the biggest threats to our rights come from like gigantic corporations, not necessarily the state, because the state can only do so much. And at times there's also gridlock and all that. So you'll see them try to pull shenanigans. I also think that you may see the administrative state try to get its licks in as well through the ATF. But for now, if Republicans were smart, they would be campaigning like completely against this stuff. And also at the state level, they'd be prepping for nullifying gun control too. I would say they should be preemptively doing it and making and start getting their states to ignore the current set of gun control laws on the books if they had any stones. But that's up to the gun rights community to push Republicans and other people and other pro-gun leaning reps their way.
Yeah, and speaking of guns, I was talking with James earlier in the week, commenting how here in Mexico, they've been doing some turn in your guns drives. Basically, I assume people who have guns not registered, not legal guns, you know, no questions asked. And you get in exchange a microwave or an espresso machine. I mean, I guess you could use that in self-defense if you had a really good aim like David, you know, versus Goliath. If you could just hit the home invader just right with the espresso machine, you could take him down. So
I mean, if you're like a bodybuilder or like some type of like power sport athlete, you might be able to generate enough damage there to neutralize your assailant.
But you know, I watched a brutal video clip yesterday. Ed Calderon, who's gotten famous from his appearances on Joe Rogan's show. I interviewed him on my Geopolitics and Empire. He's got a crazy Telegram channel that's really graphic stuff that he posts, and he posted a clip from Celaya, Guanajuato, which I've passed through. I know people who live in that area, and I've actually stayed near that area. And it's a clip of a market, you know, open market stall there in Celaya, Guanajuato. And there's an older man selling his wares. And you have this cartel, Nueva Generación Jalisco. They just go right up to him and pop him full of lead. And talking about the piso, that's the extortion tax from the cartels or crimes. So I'm assuming that this old man refused to pay to the cartels, you know, their tax, whatever it is. It's not cheap either. It's like 10, 20, 30%. I don't know. You can go watch the video on Ed Calderon's Telegram channel, Ed's Manifesto, and just to see something like that, just walk right up to him, pop him full of lead, kill him, put a sign on him, and using that as a warning, like, you don't pay the extortion fee to us, this is what happens to you. This is Mexico, unfortunately. So, yeah. Anyways, moving on to disinformation on your Substack, you wrote, so we saw the Disinformation Governance Board of the DHS come and go, at least temporarily, and take down my PayPal. And now, I don't know if this is the same thing. They're trying something similar or is it separate, but I like your title. Kamala Harris will be heading new disinformation task force. Harris is an unapologetic authoritarian. You better be careful, Jose. You might get thrown into the algorithm ghetto.
Yeah.
Well, what's going on here?
Well, yeah, this is like the latest announcement of this just new task force to protect a lot of like future nominees that Democrats put forward who have controversial backgrounds from online criticism. And put simply, it's done to shut down online dissent that's going to be launched at the slew of nominees that these people want to put in positions of government agencies who tend to be pretty tyrannical or very much on the multicultural left. And it's another way, it's another reason why I was telling people, even with this this information governance board getting shut down, the fight is far from over. And they're going to find some other way. They're going to use something more optical, some other agency, or put someone else that's more authoritative. Because that Nina Jacobowitz broad, whatever her name is, that was nominated, was kind of cuckoo. And when you look at her, it was like really farcical. And some of these type of nominees, they do it in like trial balloon fashion to see and gauge the reaction from the public. So as to measure how hostile they'll be to some of the power grabs that the state puts forward. And it was clear that this disinformation governance board provoked a pretty huge reaction from across the conservative sphere. You saw nearly every faction of the conservative movement reject that, and even a lot of people on like the dissident left too. So they're kind of rolling back they rolled back that project, but now they're using this new task force. And I believe that they will be leaning more on big tech to try to carry this out more so, as opposed to doing the traditional 1984, we're sending government goons at your door. They're probably going to try to target a lot of right-wing accounts and websites that expose the backgrounds of a lot of these nominees in the future. Because that's one thing that's unique about this regime, is that it can adapt to a lot of like the pressure that's being put by other people, and they will outsource a lot of their behavior to the private sector because the US still has pretty strong free speech protections compared to, say, Europe, which makes a lot of the managerial class have to get creative when it comes to the tyranny they want to impose on others.
Kind of cuckoo. She was off the wall. Anyways, I would agree with you. We're going to have more of this fascism, the private sector carrying out orders from, Mordor. In any case, we're going to take our first tequila, mezcal, vodka break. You can check out Jose's work on Twitter at Jose A.L. Nino on Substack at josbcf.substack.com. This is TNT Radio.
Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
We're going to be joined now by William Kay.
Pleasure to be here, Mark.
Fascinating, an important discussion. You heard me, I just referenced, I don't know if you were listening, but I was referencing the 19th century academic who was warning of the climatic excess in the 19th century. And I think that surprises a lot of people that people were warning of this kind of sort of doomsday, that long ago, 150, almost 200 years ago.
Well, I've long said to people that say, well, the environmentalism, didn't that come from the 60s? I say, yeah, it came from the 1860s. Was Marsh saying that, that's when Ernst Haeckel invented the word ecology, which is a complete pseudoscience and always has been. It was premised from its very inception on the notion that human activity is disrupting nature and there's going to be this great natural rebellion. Once again, that dates to the 1860s.
The Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
So many of your favorite libertarian celebrities are here at Freedom Fest. You not only get to hear them speak, you get to talk to them because our speakers are part of the action.
Freedom Fest is an amazing opportunity for freedom lovers from all over the world to meet and interact, strategize, and come up with ways to advance our principles both in the culture and within the political space.
Don't miss Freedom Fest,
the largest liberty event of the year,
July 13th to 16th at the Mirage in Las Vegas. For more information, go to freedomfest.com.
The PCR test for monkeypox. Another crap PCR test for another crap virus. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Speaking of monkeypox, crap virus, during the break I just read, Croatia has confirmed the first case of monkeypox. And tomorrow, the World Health Organization and Tedros the Terrorist are going to announce whether they are going to lock us all down again. So my summer on the Adriatic may be escaping. I may not be able to go home. In any case, we're back with Jose Nino. Find him on Twitter at Jose A.L. Nino. Same on Telegram. I just became a premium Telegram supporter. And you can find a Substack, josbcf.substack.com. And what we were talking about before the break, Kamala Harris heading up the Disinformation Governance Board 2.0, you had another story providing an example of more of this regarding Slack. I don't use Slack. Some people use this thing called Slack. And the case that you highlight, I think recently I heard about someone else as well getting their banned from Slack. But you talk about the messaging program Slack kicking off. It kicked the Federation for American Immigration Reform off the platform. So, and I use a number of different services for my podcast and other stuff. And I'm just wondering at what point are they going to cancel my account and I won't be able to do anything? You know, I recall there was a Palestinian who was using Zoom and they were like kicked off or banned from using Zoom. So it's like, is this the end game eventually? So what's going on with this Slack here?
Yes, this case is something I've really stressed, that if you're on the immigration patriot movement, which is like you want to restrict both illegal and legal migration the way FAIR groups like VDARE, which have even faced more intense censorship than FAIR has, you guys are going to be one of the primary targets because immigration is one of the sacraments of the managerial regime. Again, this is the cheap labor, cheap votes strategy that the DC swamp wants to use to annihilate demographically the historic American nation. Thus, they will put a lot of emphasis on twisting the elbows of tech companies like Slack or whatever to deny services to FAIR and similar groups. And I believe this will be the first of several waves of denial of services to other groups that talk about issues that matter on the right, because you definitely are not seeing this happen to a neoconservative organization, for example. Yeah, and there, it's very clear. And to your point about the Palestinian guy, that it does not surprise me because of the fact that all the groups on the left that get canceled are the ones that challenge the Zionist lobby. So those, when you start challenging a lot of these elite groups, do expect some form of cancellation from your banks, software services you use, and even like the social media platforms. That's where we're at in the 2020s. And I believe this will intensify because managerialism is here to stay. And we're fighting a very unique battle where it's not just the state going after you, because even if you could, you can beat the state, there's some gigantic soulless corporation that functions as the Pinkerton for police force for the managerial state. And they will gladly make your life miserable.
And I mean, if you just think about it logically, okay, they say you're a conspiracy theorist, there's no, you know, open borders, replacement migration thing. But then if you start like talking about migration in that sense, they ban you, which would just then add more fuel to the fire, evidence supporting that there is something to that so-called conspiracy theory. So it's like, then why are you ban- I mean, historically, it's the people who are telling the truth that are getting censored. So anyways, and there's another yet another sort of example that you covered, which was, well, this one is weird. And again, it's kind of confusing. Christian patriot in Washington state is arrested for quoting the Bible. So he's a Navy veteran. He runs a sheepskin business. And he goes, I guess, door to door evangelizing. And then what had happened? Then eventually he was swarmed by cops on his property and they arrested him for what?
Okay. This guy, he has like a small business and all of that. And he's an active user of Gab. And when he caught wind of this pride parade taking place close to where he lived, he started posting about how he's going to attend the pride parade. And then he posted biblical scripture condemning what was going on in this pride parade, specifically how it's promoting sodomy and other degenerate values. That triggered a bunch of online leftists that tried everything possible to organize a online lynch mob to ruin this guy's life. And then they eventually said that what he was saying constituted hate speech and was like somehow an incitement to violence, because he did say he was going to participate at this event to protest it, though he stressed that he was going to only hand out literature in a peaceful manner. But that was way too much for the authorities there. So they had to basically like send an entire detachment of law enforcement to arrest the guy for basically like committing some arbitrary act of hate speech. And it's just like, it's totally absurd. This is Washington state. So this is a pretty solidly liberal state that is thoroughly anti-gun, anti-free speech, and very PC, like most of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I always, I'm never the kind of person to use foul language. And I mean, anything that you're going to talk about should always be diplomatic, nonviolent. I mean, I don't think it's even wise to use, you know, to curse. So I don't know exactly what he was saying, but this is nuts. It says they slapped him with a felony hate crime charge. So yeah, just that's the way things are going. Let's turn a bit to foreign policy. You've been talking about Iran and Trump and World War III. The supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, believes that the West is exploiting the Russo-Ukrainian crisis to justify further expansion of the North Atlantic terrorist organization. And he made these comments during a meeting with the honorary dean of my alma mater, ex-honorary dean, Kazakhstan's Kasym Jomart Tokayev, the president, who paid a visit to Tehran that weekend. And I don't think he's wrong, Khamenei. I think, of course, NATO is using the situation to expand the war to expand itself. And today we just, I think, heard that Moldova and Ukraine have been accepted as EU candidates for EU membership. And I like what my other fellow contributor, like yourself, to Geopolitics and Empire, Nikolai Mikovic, who I'll be talking to tomorrow on TNT, he says, welcome to the EU's eternal waiting room regarding Ukraine's EU membership candidate status. So what are your thoughts on what Khamenei says and NATO lately?
I mean, he's correct. You don't have to share the Islamic Republic of Iran's revolutionary ideology to understand that NATO is a very predatory institution that wants to expand as much as possible, not only like military terms, but also in soft power terms, to turn most of these countries, especially like in Eastern Europe, into just like facsimiles of like the really degenerate collective West that goes from the mindless consumerism to the LGBT degeneracy that's prevalent in those countries. And NATO is very much like that. It markets itself as a defensive alliance, but when you look at how it expands, it's very much aggressive. It's just not always in military form. That's something we should always keep in mind. There's many ways to skin this cat, and NATO has done a fantastic job of trying to encroach on countries that don't want anything to do with NATO, and or they're trying to expand as much as possible while not recognizing certain geopolitical realities, such as, for example, when you have an ascendant Russia, it's going to have its own say within its backyard, and it's not going to tolerate certain types of military arrangements and alliances. And when you don't hear that, if you don't take those concerns into consideration, you create security crises like the ones that you see in the Russo-Ukrainian war right now. And yes, and I'd say this as well, from the Iranian perspective, they've seen multiple decades of external interference from all the way in the 1950s and the coup that toppled Mossadegh to the subsequent sanctions and other policies that the collective West and Israel have pursued against it for decades. And the Iranians have every reason to be skeptical of these huge alliances and balancing coalitions that are being assembled by either Western actors or Zionist elements like Israel and their Arab lapdogs as well. So he has every reason to be skeptical of these type of universalist agendas that are being launched against his regime, because Iran is also, like Russia, a civilization state in its own right. And this meeting with the leader of Kazakhstan is an example of how Iran is trying to build stronger relationships with Central Asian republics, which historically have been in the Persosphere or adjacent to it, because Iran is a very long-standing civilization that with a rich history and that used to be a great power in its own right during its Persian imperial phase. And that's the what we're seeing now, the emergence of several civilization states asserting themselves and telling the world that we have interests that should be respected as well. It's not only the US and whatever Western country is in power that can dictate the rules of the game.
I just retweeted and followed Khamenei. I wonder if that puts me on a North Atlantic terrorist organization watch list. But he tweeted.
It'll get you there or some Zionist board too. But what's the difference?
Given, as Alan McLeod of Mint Press published yesterday, a piece, I haven't finished reading it, but talking about how Twitter is hiring like mad FBI agents and Alphabet agency folks. And Khamenei tweeted, concerning the issue of Ukraine, the main problem is that the West is seeking to expand NATO whenever they can without taking anything into consideration. He also said the U.S. and the West always seek to expand their influence in different regions, including in East and West Asia, as well as to strike a blow against countries' independence and sovereignty. As you said, I'm not on board with the whole Mohammed thing, but he just made an objective observation of reality right here that I would agree with. And let's talk about something a bit more, on a lighter subject, World War III. I don't think we talked about this last time, but former President Trump warned that Biden's handling of the Ukraine conflict could lead to World War III. Unfortunately, we can't read tweets from President Trump because he has been deplatformed. But he said, we have a war in Ukraine and perhaps it's going to lead to World War III because of the way we're handling it. And just real quick, some stuff that I've posted to my Telegram. Stripes reports that Russia's war in Ukraine appears to be swaying German people's stance on the storage of U.S. nuclear weapons after decades of staunch advocacy for the removal of NATO's most powerful deterrent. And for the first time, a majority of German respondents in the recent survey supported maintaining U.S. nuclear weapons in Germany, with some favoring their modernization. So there's that. And then we've got German General Ingo Gerhards in the Bild.de paper warning that the NATO states must prepare themselves for having to use nuclear weapons in an emergency. When asked how the Northern Alliance would react if Putin dropped nukes, he said, for credible deterrence, we need both the means and political will to implement nuclear deterrence if necessary. And harsh words going back and forth. We had Yevgeny Buzhinsky on Russian state TV say that the West is playing with fire and blockading Russia. And the panelists are realizing they're heading for a major war with NATO. So things really don't look good. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, they don't look good. And the Germans should absolutely know better than to basically act like a lapdog for the U.S. And it's unfortunate because Europe is very much participating in a really dumb geopolitical and geoeconomic endeavor by trying to turn this proxy war into Russia, into a direct war. And one can say that, yeah, like the US is imposing itself on Europe and all that, but at the same time, European leadership has agency. They could take a different approach and a much more pragmatic approach and balance out Russia, play off Russia and the US and chart a different course. Unfortunately, they're siding with the US, the Atlanticist crowd, and much to their detriment, because I don't see how they benefit. If anything, this is very much accomplishing many of the goals a lot of British geopolitical strategists have always desired, is to really weaken continental Europe as much as possible. And I just don't see how countries like Germany especially come out of this like intact. They're going to have all sorts of economic problems and all of that once the dust settles, and hopefully cooler heads prevail when it comes to this whole Lithuania blockade of Kaliningrad, because this is one of the main reasons why the people like Pat Buchanan and Ron Paul in the 90s were warning about these Eastern European nations being added to NATO, because yes, they have very legitimate grievances with Russia. There's no denying that if you study the history, but that's not any of the US's concern at the end of the day. And because of that, we could be dragged into a war because, let's see, Estonia or Lithuania has some historical beef with Russia and they saber rattle and miscalculate. And then we have an Article 5 scenario where all these countries have to convene and determine if we have to go to war just because Russia took like a punitive action against Estonia or whatever Baltic country. That's this is like in a reason like 9999 why like the US has to get out of NATO, and Europe needs to build its own security architecture, and same with Eastern Europe. But we're at a point where on any given week during this crisis, the chances for nuclear escalation can go like 0 to 100 in a few seconds. And we need strong statesmanship. We need, this is like a time when we should have like the von Metternichs or Bismarck types that can like actually step up to the plate and figure out a compromise. But nope, we're stuck with the likes of people like Olaf Scholz or Ursula von der Leyen, total airheads and empty suits that with nothing upstairs and that cannot hammer out like some reasonable compromises and negotiated settlements in this conflict. And I think that we're just going to continue to see a series of boneheaded escalations, and hopefully some rational figures can step up and allay these tensions.
Our favorite academic in Vladivostok, Artyom Lukin, tweets, I agree with him. It's basically an Orwell scenario. He says, it's increasingly clear that the only geopolitical choice left for the Europeans is whether they want to live under an Atlantic empire governed from Washington or a Eurasian empire controlled from Beijing. I think he nails it. And with that, we're going to take our second tequila break. You can check out Jose Nino on Twitter at Jose Al Nino and Substack, josbcf.substack.com. We'll be right back on TNT Radio.
It has come to this. Heatwave lockdowns are now a thing.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Due to a heat wave, regions in France are now banning outdoor gatherings and concerts until officials declare the heat wave over. You thought the COVID lockdowns were an anomaly? Welcome to the heat wave lockdowns. Officials in France banned people from attending concerts, gatherings, and events due to the safety concerns over the heat wave. You are no longer allowed to make this decision for yourself. Unelected government bureaucrats now determine what you can and can't do outside in the summer. In one of the biggest ironies, the annual resistance celebrations are now banned until officials declare the heat wave over. Expect a cold wave lockdown next, and climate lockdowns are already on the horizon. The wacky world in which we live. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
As an Olympic athlete, I prepare for everything. So when I became pregnant, I thought I was ready. But at 32 weeks, I was diagnosed with severe preeclampsia and had an emergency C-section. Looking back, had I known the warning signs, I would have talked to my doctor sooner. Too many women die of pregnancy-related complications, and most are preventable. If you or someone you know is pregnant or recently had a baby, learn the warning signs. It could help save her life. Hear her.
Mask mandates don't work.
No.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Let's do it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, we're back on the Hrvoje Moric show. We've been chatting with Venezuelan American analyst Jose Nino. Check out his Substack, josbcf.substack.com. He's producing a number of interviews that I can't even keep up with, that I've got bookmarked, of people that I've never even heard about often, which is what I like. I don't like listening to people who do like the 50 podcast tour, you know, like I like to learn about new voices, new perspectives from different parts of the world as well. And you wrote another piece on Big League talking about, well, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, and believing that the 2024 U.S. elections will be a mess. And I definitely do think that will be the case. Some people even question if there will be an election. Some people are even questioning the 2022, the primaries, that they may launch a monkeypox pandemic or something and force, like, basically do what they did last time, mail-in voting, just total chaos. And I think that this is a very real possibility. And on top of that, economic collapse, we don't even know if we could have hyperinflation, just everything collapsing, and then martial law, who knows what's going to happen. Those are extreme scenarios, but what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, Kinzinger is one of the worst Republicans in the House, and I'm glad he's retiring, because he's like a total neocon. He's like bad on like so many issues, from gun control to escalating tensions with Russia and Ukraine. And he's a never Trumper of the highest order now. And he's probably going to end up with some cushy think tank job or some type of lobbying work afterwards, and get a bunch of appearances on the bobblehead media, whether it's like MSNBC, CNN, or whatever. And yeah, he won't be missed, but I think he may be onto something, that it is going to be messy due to the shenanigans people are going to pull throughout the 2024 elections. And I believe this is going to be the norm from elections now going forward in the US, because we've already seen from like 2016 to 2020, people have already questioned the legitimacy of like two elections. One where people thought that Russia interfered, and then the other where people thought that Biden is like a total like CCP shill and use a lot of election so-called fortification to get elected and all that. And while I believe the former case with Trump, those allegations are BS. While there is some like nuggets of truth to the 2020 elections due to election irregularities and the Biden family's weird connections with China, what we're seeing in a macro perspective, especially when you kind of look at this from a bird's eye point of view, like you're a foreigner and you don't have any biases, you're seeing like a US that has an increasingly unstable electoral process where people are beginning to question like the legitimacy of electoral results. And that means that this system that we currently have in the US is not really long for this world. As things get worse, as the economic situation deteriorates, as you see the US experience a cultural collapse from the birth rates to the degeneracy that's taking root across like almost every ambit of social life, the US as we grew up and knew it is going to look very different. And I do believe that elections are already pretty much a ceremonial process where have very little substance, especially at the federal level, but they're going to become more of an afterthought, the way like you see monarchies in Europe as figureheads, because you're going to just see much more naked administrative tyranny and other forms of social engineering from big tech and other institutions, because those are really our masters. And I think this electoral tension that you're seeing at the moment is just signs that we're transitioning into a new era of instability. And I don't think that the current American system will be able to keep the facade on for much longer.
I would agree. The mask is coming off. And you also talked about Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's brought up Assange and Snowden and AMLO as well, the Mexican president, Lopez Obrador, apparently in one of his mañaneras, his like 5-hour long morning talks. Like, he should really stop doing that. But anyways, apparently he actually showed the collateral video. If people remember that video, I think it was like a 10-minute video from Iraq war from like 20 years ago, showing American soldiers basically like they were playing a video game, using a drone, taking out women and children and just innocent Iraqis. And he was actually showing that and saying, yeah, free Assange. He would offer Assange asylum in Mexico. And we've got Taylor Greene talking about pardoning Assange as well as Edward Snowden. These are all, this is nice and great, good gestures, good talk. I'm just very pessimistic. I mean, we're talking about like the, what's the Star Wars, you know, the Empire, the Death Star. We're talking about this huge, I just don't see how Snowden or Assange get out of this. Really, I don't see any way out for them. You know, what are your thoughts on Assange, Snowden, Taylor Greene, AMLO?
Well, first off, I'd rather see AMLO just golf and then only talk about Assange as opposed to like talking about other like North American Union stuff. And like, yeah, like he should just stick to that. If he did that, he'd be my favorite. If he like were able to give Assange's freedom and rip him away from the tentacles of the US, he'd easily be my favorite executive. But yeah, it's unfortunate. Marjorie Taylor Greene, you should just know how low we've gotten when Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I have a lot of respect for, is like the only politician that will step up to the plate and defend Julian Assange. And it's actually kind of funny because you see a lot of pro-Trump people, the Trump coalition, attack Assange when Assange's leaks and all that and WikiLeaks' information really did a number on Hillary Clinton in 2016. So they would at least, if they had any political sense, return the favor for Assange. But more broadly, I believe Assange is a legit journalist. What he's doing is uncovering the nastiest aspects of the military-industrial complex and all of the national security state, which is why he's so hated. But yeah, I'm deeply saddened by this extradition. But then again, it was expected because like the UK, like come on, they've also have bent the knee to Uncle Sambo. So yeah, it's a travesty, and he's probably going to end up rotting in a American prison for journalism, essentially.
Yeah, just AMLO, just thinking. I mean, it's great what AMLO says again, but regarding Assange, but at the same time, it's like, dude, you've got plenty of things to worry about here in Mexico. I was just telling you earlier about we've got criminals just shooting Mexican, you know, poor Mexican vendors in Guanajuato. I think you better deal with that first before you even start talking about Assange. And I think this principle should apply for most politicians anywhere and everywhere. We've got a couple of minutes left. Any other thoughts? Or as well, you interviewed Anatoly Karlin, who I think he's in, I'm assuming he's in Russia. He's a popular...
Yes, in Moscow.
He's a popular analyst. Any takeaways from him?
Yeah, he's actually pretty good on these issues. He's lived in the States and he's well spoken on geopolitics. And one thing he noted that I think is really funny that you should tell your Reaganite conservative friends that always share Alexander Solzhenitsyn, stuff like the Gulag Archipelago, is that Alexander Solzhenitsyn was very anti-NATO. And in fact, he was a hardcore Russian nationalist. He wasn't just some liberal dissident that was wanting to carry out DC's agenda in Russia. He wanted to see a strong Russia that occupied a civilizational space. And part of that Russia would be the regathering of Russian lands that were effectively partitioned by the Leninists during the Bolshevik Revolution, because parts of Ukraine, of modern day Ukraine, used to be part of historical imperial Russia. So he talked a lot about that, that there are parts of the ex-Soviet space that were historically part of the Russian imperial state. And he sees that the new Russian nationalism is about regathering those lands and bringing those Russians back into the Ruski Mir, the Russian world. I found that pretty interesting. And he basically gave a spiel, like the same spiel that like the Eurasian century is here for the most part. And he's pretty bullish on China. He he does see it as a legit peer competitor to the U.S., citing its largely like educated population and the fact that it has a lot of engineers and all of that. And he does see it as a legitimate challenger, and he expects it to work pretty well with Russia.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Solzhenitsyn, and I'm not a fan of NATO, so I think that's good. And real quick, I found a piece of news. I haven't confirmed it. Supposedly, Putin has warned former countries of the USSR, which span most of Eurasia, that if any of them defy Russia, they will see a repeat of the Ukrainian invasion. So that's kind of interesting. We need to confirm that. Best place to find you, Jose, is Substack. Where?
Yeah, Jose Nino Unfiltered, Substack, and Twitter at Jose Al Nino.
Well, you have a peachy weekend. We'll talk to you next week. Stick around. We should be back after the break with the amazing author Jefferson Morley. This is TNT Radio.